receptivity to God is like the consummate human virtue. And women are icons of that in a really beautiful way, because our bodies kind of visually proclaim, or biologically proclaim in an embodied way, that the ability for receptivity to be life-giving.
Hi there. Welcome to episode 3 of Girl Boss Interrupted. I'm Helen Roy. Today, I had the distinct pleasure of speaking with professor and dean at George Fox University, Abigail Favale, whose book, The Genesis of Gender, is forthcoming through Ignatius Press. The book addresses several of the contradictions at the heart of mainstream pop feminism, especially its progenitors' insistence on erasing and nullifying and minimizing both the concept and the material reality of womanhood, which is why I wanted to speak to Abigail, because this really is, in my view, one of the central dehumanizing features of the girl boss sort of idea. The idea that there's nothing essential about being a woman, and that our behavior can and should mimic male behavior in every way, every aspect of our lives. I think that this myth, this fiction, is deeply destructive to women's hearts and minds and souls. And we had a great conversation about this, and touched on topics that you might not expect, like transgenderism and teens. And really a big part of this podcast, and why I wanted to start this podcast, is because I want better for my daughters. I want better for teenage girls who are, being, they're a little bit downstream of the girl boss narrative, but they're more upset than anybody. And I think that getting to the truth of womanhood will help people see more clearly, help people to see, if you help people to see the true, you will help them to see the beautiful and the good. And I was so honored to speak to Abigail, because we really covered a lot of these topics, and she seems to share this view. So once again, if you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. I really thank all of you who continue to tune in. This has been a lot of fun so far. Talking to these women has been really just such a highlight for me. And I feel like I'm learning a lot as I go, and I hope that you feel the same way. So if you do, please subscribe and enjoy the interview with Abigail Favale. Okay, so welcome to the podcast, Abigail Favale.
Hi, good to see you, Helen.
Great to see you too. I want to start this the way that I start most of these things, which is to ask you how you got to where you are. I want to hear a little bit about your journey from feminist background to whatever it is you are now, and you can characterize that however you'd like to.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what does here mean, where I am? Okay. Right. Yeah, no, that's fair. So, I'll give kind of a rough sketch, and then if you want to ask me to elaborate on any point, just let me know. Sure. I was raised an evangelical Christian, and I grew up in the Western United States in the kind of Mormon belt. So pretty conservative, religious context. And when I went to college, I mean, there are many good things about my upbringing, but one of the frustrating things, I think, was there just wasn't really much space for women's voices or perspectives in the culture in which I grew up in. There was a very restrictive idea of femininity, like the feminine virtues are, obedience, submission, women are allowed to teach children or other women, but, that kind of that kind of thing. So women were very much like kind of behind the scenes, and I never heard a sermon on a woman. You know, I remember in Sunday school hearing stories about women like Ruth, and I loved reading in the Bible, especially in the Old Testament, because there's some really, I don't know, can I say badass on your podcast? Is that okay? I don't know. You can edit that out. I'll just say there are some real powerhouse women in the Old Testament, you know, and I enjoyed reading those stories, but it seemed like the picture I was given in my kind of church context didn't even really match what the Bible depicts, even though this was a very, like, you know, biblical, almost fundamentalist kind of religious context. So by the time I went to college, I was really, I think, primed to begin to explore the question about what it means to be a woman. What's the spiritual significance of being a woman, especially for someone like me? Like, there are ways in which I'm stereotypically feminine. There are also ways in which I'm not. I'm kind of a competitive person. I love sports. You know, that was really important to me in high school. And I was often in very male contexts. I was a philosophy major, one of the only women philosophy majors. And so I began to kind of question this because I was often very aware of the fact that I was the only woman in a lot of spaces where I was. And so I was kind of wondering. So the woman question became really important to me. And that's when I started looking into feminism and reading feminist biblical hermeneutics, feminist theology, some feminist philosophy. And I just kind of like cannonballed into that. I was like, this is awesome. This is where I will find it. This answer to the question that I seek. And there was a while, I think, for the first couple of years, I think some of my feminist explorations did feed into also this growing sense of spirituality. I was also going to an Anglican church for the first time, reading about these amazing women saints. So for a while there, this kind of discovery of this feminine genealogy that I'd never really explored strengthened my faith. Mm-hmm. But by the time I graduated from undergraduate, in my undergraduate years, the way I kind of understand it now is that feminism had really become my religion, right? So instead of having primarily a Christian, an evangelical Christian framework from which I then viewed other things like feminism and took what was compatible, I had really flipped that. And so I now had this kind of feminist framework, and then I would, you know, take parts of Christianity or whatever that fit that. I think by then I'd really adopted a hermeneutics of suspicion toward Christianity, toward the Bible. So I didn't really have any sense of authority. Where are the guardrails here, you know, in my kind of reinterpretation of Christianity? It was really, I just kind of saw it as up to me. So I think I'd pretty much entered a fairly postmodern, or if that's the term you want to use, postmodern form of Christianity. So in graduate school, I followed my love of feminist philosophy and got a master's in women's writing and gender theory, and then a doctorate in feminist literary criticism and women's writing. And so that became like my gig, you know. I was like an academic feminist. Like, that was my job, that was my passion, that was my religion. I still considered myself kind of nominally Christian, but there wasn't really any content to that. And it's nothing I practiced, you know. Like, I didn't go to church, I didn't pray. It was just this kind of like intellectual sort of like, yeah, I like the incarnation. It's a cool concept. But there wasn't much more to it than that. So what rocked that boat near the end of my 20s? There were kind of three crises that unfolded around the same time at the end of my 20s. So the first one, I think, was a deepening spiritual crisis, because the kind of Christianity that I'd fashioned for myself was just an empty shell, really. I mean, it was nothing that really provided any kind of structure to my life. And it was certainly nothing that could bring about any kind of spiritual transformation or conversion. You know, it was almost like a club affiliation or something. And I was working in a Christian college where I currently am. So I was in this Christian educational context where I was continually having to confront the idea of faith and spiritual formation. And I was expected to help my students kind of form their own faith identity. Of course, mine was just really on the rocks. So I kind of reached this point where I'd lived in cognitive dissonance for a long time. And I reached this point where I had this moment, I think, of self-honesty, where I was like, you know what? I either need to like actually be a Christian or just, you know, call it and say I'm good and just kind of go into this agnostic space where I've basically been living. So another big piece of this crisis was that I became a mother. And that really just changed everything that I thought I knew. My first child is a boy, so I also became a mother to a son. The experience of pregnancy and childbirth, certainly I had to confront the kind of feminist dogma about being not just pro-choice, but like laudatory about abortion. This is an awesome thing, you know, and like the linchpin of women's freedom. Right. Cause you know, it's amazing to see an ultrasound of a 12-week-old developing baby and to see, wow, this is still the first trimester. I thought this was just, you know, not yet a human being, but you know, I saw him like 12 weeks, fully formed human being, kicking around, moving. He didn't even really look like an alien. He was just like a baby, you know, in the first trimester. Right. It was just incredible. So that really kind of rocked my world. Also just the experience of early motherhood when you're kind of in this symbiotic relationship with an infant, because pregnancy kind of is a very symbiotic experience, but there's also a little bit abstract because you're pregnant, but also you haven't really like seen your baby face to face yet. Right. But then after birth and still having this very strong like biological and physical tie through lactation and just through that bonding, I think the feminist emphasis on autonomy and independence just no longer seemed to hold. It no longer seemed to explain my experience. So I didn't like become anti-feminist all of a sudden, but it was enough that it kind of disrupted that, that framework, that kind of totalizing framework that I had adopted. And then, so the upshot of this spiritual crisis, this feminist crisis, is that I kind of really abruptly became Catholic. And that's a bizarre part of the story, which is actually really short to tell, but it doesn't tell much because it doesn't really make sense, except that I think in my moment of weakness, God just kind of, I was like teetering on the fence, like, should I be a Christian? Should I not? Nah, nah, nah. And then he just kind of like pushes me over into like the Catholic Church. but then after I became Catholic, that's when I began to have over the next couple of years a really profound worldview shift when it comes to the question of woman, embodiment, all these things. Because I still, even when I became Catholic, I still had these feminist objections like the non-male priesthood, contraception, same-sex marriage. So I wasn't totally on board with the Catholic vision of womanhood. And but I was like, you know what, I want to understand it before I decide whether I'm on board or not. And so then I spent a couple of years just reading deeply, and I found such a more satisfying answer than I had ever found, certainly in evangelical Christianity, but also in feminist thought, because the irony I think I discovered in feminist thought is that feminism is and always has been kind of deeply uncomfortable with the reality of sexual difference. So there's always been this irony at the heart of feminism. Like, we don't really want to talk about like what women are. We just kind of want to use the term in a politically convenient way and really reject any kind of narrative about stable or essential differences. And so because of that suspicion, feminism can't give a satisfying answer to the question of like, what does it mean to be a woman and what is significant about that, especially spiritually? And so that quest that I had been on for like, you know, since I was a late teen, was not really answered until I became Catholic. So, since then, I guess this is like where I am now. Right. So, you know, so I'm still an academic. I'm a dean, I'm a professor. I work at George Fox University, a Christian school, Protestant school. And I still do, like, all of my writing and speaking is on women's issues and gender. Like, that's still my passion. That's still my beat, I guess, if I'm a beat cop. But it's from such a different, such a different vantage point. Like, when I first had that worldview shift, when I, in my kind of Catholic conversion, I went through this phase of like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do with my life? I've been this, like, I've made this career as like a professional feminist academic. And now my view on those things has shifted. Like, what do I do now? But it turns out that's actually been very helpful, because now mm-hmm. I'm able to write about those issues with an in-depth knowledge of what gender theory is, what feminist theory is. And I can, I think, dialogue more effectively with that world as a Catholic now. And that's so, yeah, that's kind of where I am.
That's fascinating. I definitely hear what you're saying about the sort of internal irony of feminism and in calling itself a woman's movement and then only being able to define womanhood insofar as this is what women aren't, you know, or shouldn't be. And to the extent that they say this is what a woman should be, it's a completely gender neutral vision, or even a masculine vision,
right? And that's another irony, right? That certainly the kind of, like, you know, the girl boss ideal that you've written about and that you're investigating and talking about, that's really modeled on a masculine ideal, right? Even the emphasis, the feminist emphasis on contraception and abortion, shows a bias toward mimicking male biology, at least in related to reproduction. So it seems like the implicit message is basically what it looks like for a woman to be free is to become as much like a man as possible, right? To be free from the things that make us female. And we're seeing that in such a strange way in our cultural moment as well, with the way kind of gender is now being envisioned. But I don't know, we can get into that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good launching point to get into your work and your book that's coming out, The Genesis of Gender. I'm going to pull a quote that I thought was really brilliantly and concisely put. The current medical paradigm pathologizes female fertility. And so I kind of want to ask you what you mean by that.
That's great. The current medical paradigm pathologizes female fertility. Well, I think the most obvious way it does that is the emphasis on the birth control pill as almost this kind of magic pill that women need to be on to just function in the world and to have successful lives, education, career, right? And what's interesting about, I think, especially the most common types of contraception, like hormonal contraceptions or even the IUD, like those exist by making the female reproductive system malfunction. Like, that's how they work. Like, it's explicitly trying to disrupt the normal pattern and rhythm of a woman's physiology. And the effects of that are actually not as well studied or understood as they should be. Although I'm a little encouraged that I think there, even in secular realms, there's a little bit more of, I think, a critique of that type of birth control and the narrative around that coming from various sectors, and more of a, at least there's much more of a discourse now or an acknowledgement that there are other kinds of birth control that don't actually disrupt a woman's body, like fertility awareness methods. So I think there's a dissatisfaction women have with the narrative that they've been given, that basically, you know, if you want to have any success or meaning in life, you kind of need to be on contraception from a young age, long term. So it's treated almost like like our capacity to become pregnant is treated almost like a malfunction rather than the way our bodies are designed. Like this is this ongoing female malady that we have that needs to be managed. So that way we have put kind of the burden on women and their bodies to adjust themselves to a male-oriented society rather than trying to make changes to society to better accommodate the reality of femaleness. So I would say that's one way in which female fertility is pathologized.
Yeah, I agree with that. I reflect on my you know, younger teen life and just growing up in America, what that's like. And there was a particular moment when you turned 13, 14, and all of a sudden, all of your friends are going on birth control, and they have these various reasons. You know, it's like, well, it makes my pimples go away, or their parents would just be like, well, you know, just in case. And, you know, I know you're a good girl, but this is just for your own benefit. You know, this has become, it's almost like the rite of passage to womanhood, which we can talk about, like, historically, what that might've looked like in the past. I mean, I think sort of naturally what it's been for me in real life is becoming a mother, but there's been this weird inversion now where it seems like the rite of passage to womanhood is you start taking birth control.
Right.
And the message, the implicit message that sends to people, I think is extremely, extremely damaging because it's sort of like, you know, there's this thing where my husband was telling me about this. He was getting his MBA, and there's a little learning capsule thing that was talking about intrinsic and extrinsic value, and how sometimes as a boss, when you give a promotion or recognize somebody doing something with this extrinsic value, there's actually ironically a performance shift in the negative, because by basically transactionalizing and replacing the intrinsic value, which has to do more with honor and self-respect, with, you know, a money amount, then people can more easily write it off. And so I think that's kind of the process, what happens when we just put girls on birth control, is we almost transactionalize, or we attempt to summarize all of the effects or encapsulate all of the effects of sex into this one extrinsic fact, and then all of the intrinsic value and the intrinsic meaning of sex itself sort of evaporates, or it's disrupted in a certain way. And so I think it has this hardening effect. I mean, aside from all of the biological components, there is a real hardening of the heart by I guess it's a form of atomization, really, just like separating a thing from its true meaning and giving it this, like, this false explicit meaning that cannot even begin to capture the fullness of the thing itself. So, you know, that was a bit rambly, but I do see, and there's plenty of studies to support that, you know, women and teenage girls in America are really suffering right now. And I think that has to do in many ways with our attitude toward them and towards sex, which is really captured by this whole birth control thing.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's not just, there are biological consequences to disrupting a woman's physiology, but you're right. There are these psychological consequences as well, I think, and broader cultural consequences, because I think it's the kind of assumption that women need to effectively be temporarily sterilized in order to function in the world, I think has really changed our cultural imagination. And we just don't, we've almost like forgotten that, yeah, you're right. We've forgotten like the full meaning of sex and also the meaning of like having a sexed body. And that's a good thing, right? It's not a pathology. It's not a threat to flourishing. It's also not this like service that women should be mandated to provide, right? There are like other biological ways of looking at it. But there's something I think psychologically damaging that happens when you, especially a young woman who's just coming into womanhood, and you're basically making her fear and have a lot of anxiety around her capacity to become her own fertility, right? Rather than it being this something positive, something beautiful, but something that also calls us to a certain, that calls us to responsibility. It's seen as this, like, this problem and this burden and this danger, right? Yes. And I think that has profound psychological effects. And one of them, actually, ironically, is that it makes birth control less effective, because when women have this, when basically women's awareness of their own fertility has been disrupted, they actually use birth control less effectively, right? Because if you're kind of just, if you have this sense of default sterility, then it can be harder to even remember why you're taking the pill every day or whatever. Yeah, so it has really wide-ranging effects, I think. And certainly it has greatly shifted, or, you know, greatly, I think, damaged the attitude a lot of men have toward women, like or this expectation that women should be sexually available without ever getting pregnant. And that's kind of their problem that they should have solved by now, you know.
Right.
And so men, I think, are given just more license to use women sexually without any sort of expectation that they could be bringing a new life into existence. And when that happens, which it still does happen, even when people are on birth control, it's the woman and her child who are left to bear the burden of that, right? Because the man's like, well, okay, go get an abortion, or I thought you were on birth control, right? Like, I didn't sign up for this, you know?
Right.
And that burden falls on women, and that's not a good thing.
Right. This is really, in my opinion, one of the deepest ironies of feminism, you know, aside from what we've already stated, but that the, at the end of the day, women have been the ones who have to deal with the, externalities of an ideology that was meant to, or was said to, support them and be for them, and you know, in the end has really, really damaged them. I mean, like the rates of out of wedlock birth and the rates of abortion and just the rest, there's so much about you know, these choices that women are making that I really think demonstrates that we're not in a good place psychologically and practically. And so, you know, this is the really hard thing. It's the sticking point that it's hard to make, you know, my, like, secular feminist friends or, you know, understand that, wait, no, actually these things that just because somebody says that this is a pro-woman thing doesn't make it so, especially if you take a long view of things.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think another problem with, I guess, just the contraceptive mentality takeover in our culture is, I think, has greatly contributed to the hypersexualization of women and girls, which is just, you know, escalating all the time. Like, that's, if I could point to one thing especially that has really worsened, like, because in many ways, you know, like, we've been critical of feminism, but there are some real gains that different waves of the feminist movement have made for women having access to education, women being able to own property, women being able to vote. I think those are all important moves, I think. So I think there have been, you know, there's been some good efforts in feminism, but I think one of the ways in which our culture has like deeply worsened since especially the second wave feminism is in the hypersexualization of women. And you can just, just watch any TV show, you know, or whatever, like pick anything or just and you know, the internet has, you know, technological advances have also, I think, helped escalate this. But, we're in this strange historical moment where an increasing number of young women want to just opt out of womanhood altogether. You know, they look around and they see like, oh, wow, if that's what being a woman means, you know, it means basically being this kind of sex object, then no thanks. I'd rather be a man or I'd rather be non-binary, you know, and that's just a wave that's sweeping our youth right now.
Yes, and I totally understand where they're coming from, you know. It's not hard to like completely empathize with them because everything is downstream of porn.
Yeah.
And the pornified woman is the most disgusting, like just viscerally repulsive idea of you know, anti-human sort of image. So that's a great launching point to get into the transgender issue, since we've been talking about teenage girls, and you know, you've mentioned that these teenagers are sort of looking around at that this deracinated idea of woman and saying, nah, I'd rather not, thanks. So can you sort of explain that a little bit? And then I'd like to hear too about, you know, what's your theory about gender and transgenderism, how you sort of explain that in the book.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So yeah, that's what this book you're mentioning, The Genesis of Gender, goes into this in depth. And it's a very complicated phenomenon, right? So it's not just one thing. I think there are all sorts of things feeding into this, but one of them, you know, I do think one piece of it, which is not going to explain every case, but one piece of it I do think is the hypersexualization of women in our culture. One of the kind of facts on the ground about kind of the rise in transgender identification in our culture is that, you know, kind of more classically, like very few people presented themselves to clinics to seek transition, and they were almost always men, and they were usually middle-aged. And so in the past less than a decade, we've seen those demographics shift wildly to more females than males seeking transition, and the age has really dropped. So the age group, the demographic group who's most often seeking medical transition are young women. So teenagers, early 20s. But we are seeing, even though that was the kind of the first wave, we are seeing, I think, young men as well. That is also increasing. So it shouldn't be neglected, that side of it. It's not nearly the same amount yet. I mean, it'll be interesting to see how that unfolds. Maybe there will be as many young men who do this. I don't know. So it doesn't explain everything, but in the process of doing research for the book and listening to a lot of just personal narratives about people who sought transition, some of whom detransitioned, one especially from women who sought transition, it was a very common phenomenon to hear them either actually experience a kind of sexual abuse or to talk about the experience of suddenly going through puberty and then, you know, like being exposed to pretty violent pornography at a young age, or just basically seeing this very pornified, degrading vision of what it means to be a woman, and then just really wanting to kind of like hide themselves or escape the like sexualized aspects of their body, right? Like, so breasts and right. And that creating a kind of sex dysphoria or gender dysphoria. So I do think that's a piece of it. That's, again, it's not true in every case, but I think that there is this almost like unconscious protest of young women in our culture against that kind of sexualization. Of course, the problem is that it's ultimately a kind of self-defeating or self-harming kind of protest, almost like anorexia is a similar kind of protest in a way. It's ultimately self-defeating. It's not a good thing, but yet it's also in some ways understandable. And another disturbing piece of this, like as part of the book, when I read first person accounts of trans identifying men, so men who identify as female, like, for example, Julia Serrano, his memoir called The Whipping Girl, I think. But the way he describes what it means to be a woman sounds just like the role of a woman in pornography. Like, it's basically to be a woman is to be sexually dominated. And Andrea Long Chu is another trans identifying man who speaks about what it means to be female in a similar way, right? And so it's really remarkable to see how explicit it is, that, again, not all men who are seeking transition, but some men who are seeking transition, it's almost they're pursuing this fantasy of being that pornified woman, right? So I think there are a lot of young women who are trying to escape that. Like, I don't want to be that, so I'm going to just opt out of being a woman. And then you have men who are, like, actively pursuing it. Like, they want to be that. The impact, I think, of the pornification of what it means to be a woman, you really see it, an influence in the rise of transgender identification.
Yes, I agree with that completely. And it's funny too, how it's played out for heterosexual people too, specifically for how like heterosexual people, there are different little subcultures of heterosexual people who aesthetically are sort of attempting to, you know, really assert themselves as men or as women. But one of my friends calls it male-to-male transgenderism. They have to go so far overboard to insist on their masculinity. And I think
you're almost talking about this like hyper performance of masculinity. Yes. That's interesting. Yeah, I think that's totally true. Yeah.
And women too, like women, the makeup thing, like it really feels like because I love makeup and I'm the makeup world is sort of all my weird interests, but it is so downstream of drag and like drag men in drag, men in doing the makeup thing have ironically really become the vanguard of the makeup industry.
That's so interesting. Yeah. Yeah, that is not my world. So, you know, I actually learned how to use an eyebrow pencil for the first time in my life this past summer, I think. So almost 40, you know, and that's probably as deep as I'll go, honestly. I don't know. But that's so interesting. And actually, I think I would also trace this back to, again, I think our culture in its like wholesale embrace of contraception and how that's affected our perception of what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman, it's no longer about kind of the generative role of male and female, but it's really about appearance. You know, it becomes and then that almost becomes like hyperpolarized, right? I mean, there's almost this like madman ideal, you know, where you've got like the suit, you know, the hyper feminine woman and the hyper masculine man. And I think, ironically, the transgender phenomenon does lean into those polarizations, right? Because now you'll hear, you know, from people like, "Oh, well, if you know, if a boy likes to play with My Little Ponies, then ooh, he's probably not actually a boy," right? Which is, again, a very regressive idea, actually. You know, and I would say a very kind of anti-feminist or non-feminist idea, but yet you see feminists embracing this by and large. I mean, I think today's feminist movement, the mainstream feminist movement, has just fallen right in line with this idea of, you know, defining a woman by physical appearance, which is often very stereotypical, hyped up, feminine, pornified, and also these kind of these stereotypes become the definition of what it means to be a boy or a girl, stereotypes that, you know, feminists have long sought to kind of overcome or undo. So it's yeah. another irony, I think, a self-defeating irony of contemporary feminism.
Yeah, absolutely. I see this in a lot of different ways, not just in the feminist way, but it really feels like people, like critical thinking is at an all-time low. I know this is sort of a crusty reactionary point, so I won't even go any further with it, but
I kind of want to say something. I haven't written about this yet, and it's an idea I'm kind of playing with, but sometimes I look around. I mean, I'm in academia, right? So I see a certain kind of this. One idea I'm kicking around a little bit is that there's a kind of almost like toxic femininity that's run amok in our culture, which is, suspicious of rationality, hyper emotional, defines reality by feelings. And also there's this weird kind of like, you know, like when you're in middle school and you have to go to the bathroom and all your girlfriends come with you, you know, there almost seems to be this almost like authoritarian kind of hive mind, like, oh, we all have to agree, like disagreement is threatening, you know, like, mm-hmm. Like we have to make sure that everything is totally fair, but then that can kind of manifest in strange ways. So I don't know, this is not a fully formed thought, but sometimes I look around and I'm like, oh, this reminds me of like being in junior high. And I guess the ways in which girls show aggression, it seems to be like, that's totally how, at least, you know, in my little corner of academia in the US, how aggression is still very much manifest, but it's in this very kind of like nicey, like, let's be friends, but we can only be friends if you totally agree with everything that I say. And if you don't, I'm going to shame you and exclude you from the group. You know, it's like, wow, this is junior high all over again, except that it's in the, you know, HR training, and it's in the boardroom, and it's in the higher administration.
Definitely. I think Mary Harrington wrote something about this recently for Unheard.
Good. I'll have to send that to you. Yes. Oh, good. Of course she has. She's amazing. Every time I read something Mary writes, I'm like, oh, well, I guess I don't really need to write, because she just kind of, she says everything that I want to say and funnier. So
she's so great. My last question for you is, as we were talking about earlier, it's sort of the real purpose of this podcast, the real thing that I'm trying to get at, and the question that I'm trying to answer for myself too, which is, you know, what does it mean to live virtuously as a woman in the 21st century? And there are two real basic, I think, component. There are many components to this question. You know, you could go in a million different directions, but there are two basic components that I want to pick your brain about. First, what do you think what particular virtue do the times require of women? You know, in a very specific way, what now do you think, practically speaking, how should women be thinking or behaving or seeing the world in a way that's positive and productive for their own lives?
That's such a good question. I mean, in general, I think the question of virtue. So I have like a strong allergy to the idea or language of like masculine or feminine virtues. I think because I think that virtues are human, and men and women have kind of full access to the range of human virtue. And where the masculinity and femininity come into play are basically how those virtues are lived out in the context of embodied persons, right? So I think, you know, women can be courageous and men can be humble, right? So I think that's one of the downsides of my upbringing, which tended more to say like, oh, humility and obedience, those are for women. And, you know, courage is for men, you know, that kind of thing. So that's just kind of an important caveat. So one, I think, spiritual virtue that was very important for me to learn in a specific way, is the spiritual virtue of surrender, I think, and specifically surrender to God, which is important because I think there are some versions of Christianity that kind of pervert that and redirect that from God to a male figure, right? Like women are to surrender, but they surrender to a human being rather than to God. And I think for me, that was really important because I think my feminist suspicion had really cut me off from God and hardened my heart. But learning to really realizing that like receptivity to God is like the consummate human virtue. And women are icons of that in a really beautiful way because we are, our bodies kind of visually proclaim or biologically proclaim in an embodied way that the ability for receptivity to be life-giving. And that, I think, is like a little icon of the relationship of humankind to God. So I think receiving God's love and being receptive to God and kind of resting in that, kind of surrendering to that and having, I think that is just the most important kind of spiritual virtue for anyone. But I would say, especially for women who've been maybe formed in a certain way, either in a hyper-feminist way or even in like an anti-feminist way, to either direct that surrender just to, you know, every man, that's not good. Yeah. Or to just totally squelch out and basically say, no, you should never surrender. You should never be receptive. Like, that's a sexist, you know, virtue. We shouldn't seek that. So that's one I would say. Right. And the second one, you know, the first one that came to mind actually when you asked me the question was courage. Because I think there is such a pressure to conform in our culture right now. And it kind of relates to that, you know, toxic femininity I was talking about, the like the kind of like junior high social dynamics, right? Where it's like, if you don't fall in line, then you will be rejected and shamed and we will make your life miserable, right? So I think there's a lot of just subtle bullying out there. Sometimes not so subtle. I think it's really important for women especially to be courageous in this moment and to not conform to ideologies, to not conform to political polarizations, but to really seek truth and to use language, especially in such a way that conforms as much as possible with the truth, and to not be afraid.
Oh, I can't, there's nothing to say beyond that. You know, that's the perfect place to, I think, wrap this up. Thank you so much for sharing your journey and your thoughts and your vision with me today. Do you have any parting thoughts?
You know, my only parting thought maybe is just like, Joan up. That's my favorite little phrase I learned recently, you know, like just channel Joan of Arc. You know, I mean, she's increasingly become a figure that's been important for me because I think she embodies this courage, but also this just collected reliance on God, you know, and also this, the fearlessness that comes from that. So that seems to be like the ideal combination, I think. Like, she listens to the voices in her head. Like, she listens to the divine voices, you know, and people think she's nuts. Right. But she, you know, she's courageous and also devout. And I just think that's a great combo.
Right. And always a woman. Always, you know, people have this weird idea that she was LARPing as a man when, no, she was always a woman. Right. The maiden of Orleans. And anyway, yes. So I, like I said, have loved speaking with you today. Thank you so much for being here.
It's been fun.
I hope someday we can do this again.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks, Abigail.
Yeah, thank you.